I felt that I was a monster incapable of love. You know, love to me would have to mean love for a man.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Jonathan Rauch, who works at Brookings Institution, a great journalist of many years who's also contributed to Reason. And his most recent publication is a great new ebook from The Atlantic called Denial, My 25 Years Without a Soul. You can find it at theatlantic.com/denial. John Rauch, thanks for talking with us.
Nick, it's good to see you again.
Denial, My 25 Years Without a Soul is about it's an essay about your coming to terms with being a homosexual or being gay. Early on in the book, you talk about being an invert, which is kind of a variation on work you've done about being an introvert, where you are kind of folded inward and looking inwards. And you suggest that your sexuality made you, which seemed to be at odds with everybody around you, and you weren't sure what it was or what it meant, and that it had you constantly looking inward for answers about why you seemed to feel different and aloof. Could you talk a little bit about what you mean when you talk about being inverted and how that plays out in terms of introversion or your kind of personality?
So I would say inverted and introversion, although a nice alliteration, totally different.
Okay.
An introvert is perfectly healthy way to be. It just means that you, instead of receiving energy from other people, you lose energy by socializing. An invert, which is what I was, is someone who turns their entire world and their entire personality upside down in a heroic feat of denial of who they are. And it's an attempt to distinguish that there's a state that is deeper and stranger even than the closet. You know, if you're a gay person in the closet, you probably know you're gay, you may be acting on that, but you're pretending to be straight, maybe even with yourself. If you're an invert, you have clear objective evidence every day that you are gay. You know, if you're a man, the plumbing tells you, if nothing else.
Right.
And you twist and deform your whole psyche and tell yourself crazy stories, and you tell yourself that black is white and that top is bottom and north is south in order to deny this obvious fact. And that's what I was, and
yeah,
that's what the book
you
is about.
You talk about your you were living life as a photographic negative.
Yeah, it's everything is in proportion to everything else, everything seems logical, and yet it's all completely backwards.
And that's pretty much where your soullessness came from, right? Because you were so inverted that you couldn't really afford an interior life?
Yeah, I couldn't have an interior life. I felt that I was a monster incapable of love. You know, love to me would have to mean love for a man. And that to me could not be love. That was some kind of strange wacko psychosis I had. So, you know, the ability to love is the very center of the soul for most people. You know, it kind of defines our personality, and without that you're kind of, you know, I was hollowed out. I was doing everything else in life. I was looking and acting mostly normal, but I went around with this certain interior knowledge that I, alone among all of human beings, had been born without the capacity to love.
And, you know, one of the things that I think is so memorable and touching about the book and interesting is that it is, you say you are not claiming that you were a typical teenager, that you were a typical gay person, whatever, but there's clearly an exemplary nature that reaches beyond issues of sexuality, too.
You know, yeah, Nick, the biggest surprise to me of this book, ever since I first started showing it to people, you know, I wrote it for myself thinking I was describing this kind of crazy pathology and wanted to get it on paper before I lost touch with it. It was receding, disappearing like a dream. And when I showed it to people, especially straight people, they said again and again, I lived through a version of that. And I would say, how is that possible? You weren't gay. You couldn't have experienced. Right. I mean, you know, you liked girls with boobs.
Right.
What would the problem be? And people again and again say, no, there are aspects of my personality I was at war with that I was turning upside down. I'm amazed by that.
Talk about, there's the character of Paul, your first great crush, that is the person who kind of awakened sexual longing in you, which you didn't necessarily recognize immediately as such. Talk about him and about how that changed your ability to kind of, you know, keep things in a homeostasis.
Yeah, you know, it's all so typical, yet it seemed so bizarre at the time. So there I was, you know, I started getting fascination with, you know, athletic guys, guys with muscles from earliest memories. So then I'm 13 or 14 and this guy, Paul, enters my life. He's just a classmate, but I don't think in the entire time I knew him, which was many, many years, he ever said an unkind word. So the friendship was rewarding. And, you know, I was an introvert and, you know, socially not the most adept and not good at sports, so I needed friends. The friendship was very rewarding. The other side, the roaring, raging, the crazy aunt in the basement who kept sending these signals that all I wanted was to see him with his shirt off, and then in his presence my knees would get weak and my skin would get, you know, sweaty. Right. That was not a blessing in any way. I spent so much energy for so many years trying to bottle that into a place where it wouldn't go.
But then you wrote, as you, you know, it took you a long time to kind of come to terms with being gay. Why was I so much more willing to believe I was a monster than a homosexual? And you say it's partly because of naivete. What do you mean by that? What kind of naivete?
You know, the real answer to your question, Nick, is that I don't know the answer to your question. Mm-hmm. I pose that as a question in a book, and I say maybe I was naive as an answer. You know, maybe I just didn't understand about homosexuality. This is in the 70s and right. 80s, and in those days, being gay in the 70s meant that you were out at clubs doing, this is a stereotype, right. but there was truth to it, and it's what filtered down
so
to me.
Yeah,
you know,
you're
crazy,
leather,
libertine,
you've got a mustache,
right, and you're
poppers,
having, yeah. doing nitrate poppers, you're at clubs yeah. all the time, you're having crazy wild sex, that, right. but never a family, you're alienated from right. society. I didn't want that. And then came AIDS. And that meant being gay was a death sentence. So I thought maybe it was, you know, partly naive about what being gay meant. But the truth is, to this day, having come out the other side of that and seeing how all of these nightmares about how terrible it would be to ever admit what was going on, how all of that was a complete fabrication, yeah. I still don't understand why I and a lot of other people would rather think of themselves as monsters than homosexuals.
This is one of the places where I think the book goes beyond just talking about sexual orientation, because a lot of people are more willing to think of themselves as monsters than as a, you know, an example of a type in a way. But you write that in the book, it's inexpressibly heartening to see today a whole generation of homosexuals grow up wondrously aloof from the disgust I took for granted. And I assume that's both your own disgust as well as societal
yeah.
disgust. It has gotten better, but it hasn't gotten fully.
It doesn't go away. You know, people want to be like other people. They want to be normal. They want to have kids, biological kids, with the person they love. And especially for, I think, boys, there's these elements of masculinity. And a fear of the feminine side and of what homosexuality stands for. And there's worry about discrimination. There's all of that, but for me the single best, biggest thing may be marriage. It's where the book begins. I did not figure out I was gay until I was 25, but somehow I knew that I would never get married from the age of 9 or 10. And that meant life without family. It meant no destination for love. It meant no permanent partner. It meant kind of looked at the time like a nomadic emotional lifestyle. And providing marriage, I think, is transformative. Not for everyone, but that tells, it's not just the people who go out and get married right now who are adults, it's the kids who grow up with a destination for their love, thinking about the first date and the first kiss and the first crush as leading to a home and a family and stability.
You yourself, a previous book you wrote about gay marriage, which if I'll recall the epigram at the beginning of the book, or epigraph, but you said, Michael, you're were writing to your long-term partner, marry me when we can, which, as I recall, every woman I know who read that said, that is the most romantic thing that I've ever heard. Every man said, that is the cheapest bit of an act that you could do, because you knew you could say, I'd marry you if I could, but
right,
I couldn't.
And I can't.
Yeah, but bring us up to date. Are you married?
And, we got married. So, Michael and I got married as soon as we could after the District of Columbia legalized gay marriage in 2010, and we're happily married, and it's better than I imagined.
Well, we'll leave it there. Jonathan Rauch is the author, most recently, of Denial, My 25 Years Without a Soul. It's available at theatlantic.com/denial. John, thanks very much.
Thank you, Nick.